Something about the blues makes you wonder, if you still wonder, if you still dream, what's taking Earth under?
That's Al Young with the opening lines to the title poem of his book, Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry. He read the whole thing in the first half of this interview that focused on early influences, like his family, especially his father. Music has always been an important part of Al Young's life, and no wonder, with his childhood split between the blues of the Mississippi Delta and Detroit's Motown. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with him for New Letters on the Air while he was the fall 2016 Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We'll pick back up with the second half of our conversation, but first, let's listen to a couple of cuts from the CD that accompanies his book, Something About the Blues. It gives a little insight into this poet's life.
I was trained at UC Berkeley to be a Spanish teacher. I started studying Spanish in the seventh grade at Hutchins Intermediate School on Woodrow Wilson Street in Detroit. And I've never forgotten the morning when my friend Leon Reynolds, who would stay up late, we both wanted to be disc jockeys. So we were secretly up late at night. And he would fall asleep in class, and Miss Sample, our Spanish teacher, said, Señor Reynolds, ¿qué significa la frase miles y miles de gente? And Leon came up out of a doze and he said, miles and miles of people. For those of you who don't know Spanish, it's thousands and thousands of people, but I love that, I've never forgotten it. My Spanish heart, after Chick Corea. In audible dreams, I'm forever going back to Spain. Now tell me, what's that all about? Perhaps in some past life or lives, I lived there and cared about the African presence in Iberia or New Iberia, eh? Get serious. It's probably because all my life I've been an all-night sucker for spicy rhythm, ticking and booming away like an Afro-Latinized gypsy taxi meter, waiting to be fed that long mileage. Whatever the reason or rhyme, I can think of no better fate than to end up masking my nights in the gardens of Spain. And how Spanish is Spain? With a warm, bubbling, undreamed lady whose dark-throated murmuring is song, picture it. Just a couple of music lovers, all but wasting in moonlight. With poetry damp and cooling right up under our noses, soft lips, a mustache, ay, the possibilities of Spanish. The loving tongue, listen, listen, adios, adios, mi corazón.
Thank you.
Gracias. A poem for listeners. It was Fran Lebowitz who told me that her writing students, she's an essayist and sometimes near fiction writer, creative nonfiction is what they call it, but she says that sometimes her students have a hard time writing plausible dialogue. And she thinks it's because many people think that the opposite of talking is waiting. So this is a poem for listeners. If uplifting those fanning ears, the elephant can hear ultra-high frequency mating calls placed from miles beyond this deafening sky, then why can't sultry laughter like yours, all piquancy and sass, take off? The rumble of it sometimes makes its way to parts of me I long to tour, but haven't. In shining ring within ring, the satellite brightness of your laughter lights heaven at hand, outcircling itself like a rock dropped into a pond. If Ravi Shankar could hear the gouache, that's Nora Jones's father, by the way. Some of you may or may not know that. If Ravi Shankar could hear the gouache of anguish washing through St. Coltrane's cries, or if Ravel could hear the gypsy strains of Spain that ruffled his composure a borderline away, or if bats can hear the sound of fruit flies walking, and if every city makes and leaves its own sound print, then tell me, with your next hard laugh, what animal ancestor of ours flowered in the sound of the note the chord never needs to round itself out, but takes in, thankful. Unpack, relax, and I'll tell you another one.
Al Young, reading A Poem for Listeners. Before that, My Spanish Heart, both included on the CD of selected poetry from the book Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry, published by Sourcebooks in 2008. He writes in the introduction, like poetry, the blues will always be dramatically unpredictable, sometimes torturous, and sometimes pleasurable. Music helps with the spiritual quest of this Renaissance man, who also turns to history, language, technology, the cosmos, whatever sparks his curiosity and makes it into poetry. No wonder Al Young was chosen to serve as California's State Poet Laureate from 2005 to 2008.
Let's say something about that.
Yeah, let's do.
That's a 2-year appointment.
I noticed you did it.
Three and a half years. I've got four. You know why?
Because I read about it, that it took 15 months for them to approve it or something.
It took longer than that. It took 3.5 years.
Oh, that's crazy.
Because all gubernatorial appointments have to be confirmed by the legislature, and the legislature was ornery. They didn't like my political viewpoint. And so somebody had to say, look, Arnold Schwarzenegger is not exactly a raving left-wing liberal, anything like that. And he loves Al Young's stuff. And I had thought that Maria, his wife, was the one who had chosen me. Turns out she didn't want a man at all. She wanted a woman to be poet laureate. So finally, someone who was moderate explained that if the Terminator likes Al's poetry, then what are you guys talking about? Then they came back around. What I loved about it was that the regulations said that as long as you are officially the poet laureate, you have to continue to get paid and work. And that was a wonderful, wonderful period because I was one of the few laureates who was not teaching. So I was at liberty and I could roam at large. And because I was poet laureate, it was like being knighted. And I got big paying gigs, you know, all over the state. People don't know about this because my actual salary as a poet laureate was $5,000 a year. So my son, Michael, said, Dad, that's no money. I said, wait a minute, let's look at that. I've done the math. How many poets do you know who get $437 a month, you know, for just being...
For being a poet,
I thought
right.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, that's right.
For openers, you know.
Right, right. And it got you invited to a lot of places.
Oh, my goodness,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. That's pretty neat.
One of the things that keeps me going is that we tend to, we being human beings in general, but Americans in particular, have cubbyholed poetry. Poetry can only be about this or that and so forth. And poetry is so elastic and so all-embracing that you can talk about anything in the form of a poem. Alison Deming, who lives out in Arizona, I always call her the science poet because her first book of poems was called Science because she was trained in science. And John Updike has written some really interesting poems about science and art. People don't know that Updike was trained to be an artist, so that when you look at landscapes and his novels in The Witches of Eastwick, for example, when he describes a geographical panorama, you can actually see it because he's a great writer and he was an art student and with an interest in science. And people don't take his poetry seriously, but he's a very serious poet. So I'm always looking for offbeat subjects about interesting people or phenomena that veers from the confessional mode. I get tired of people writing poems about themselves. I mean, we've got enough of that, so it leaves room for somebody else to do something else.
Well, I love poetry that can tell us a little something about history and things that have helped shape us in you know, ways that are unlikely. And there's a very short poem in this book, Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons, that I think shows that. And it's just an unusual little piece that captures something that I thought. It's called Diesel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Diesel.
Do you want to read that one?
I do. I never get to read this. And I'm fascinated by our fixation on the dark and the negative. Rudolf Diesel was an Austrian engineering and mechanical genius. And he was a contemporary of Adolf Hitler. You know, everybody knows about Hitler. You couldn't have the History Channel without Hitler. You know, they redigitized all of those old newsreels and everything just to keep it going. But Diesel was a very interesting man because he was the inventor of the internal combustion engine. And the last thing he wanted was that it be run on petroleum and fossil fuel, vegetable oil, you know, natural.
Well, I didn't realize that's what he wanted.
Yes.
Okay, wow.
And they were doing that
okay.
until the petroleum people came in.
Right.
I mean, he was a genius. He didn't go to college or anything. He was just a genius.
Yeah.
And when we go up to the pump now, and we say, what do you want, diesel? You know, that's down there. Nobody knows what that means. That was him. And his life was so weird. He gave a lot of money to culture and the arts and all of this. And, well, it's all in the poem.
Yeah.
Diesel, to Adolf Hitler, we pay tribute. We invoke him. Hitler this and Hitler that, indeed. But Rudolf Diesel, who was he? Think vegetables. Think fruit. Think French fry fat. Think drives across the continent. Think cool, straight shots and swerves up through tight hills. Think jam. Think 19th century tinker. Think sweating mule, fast up beside the car you prize. I am, therefore I do not need to think, you tell yourself again. I buy. Rudolf, Paris-born, died in English waters, as if the bell his life had tolled spelled out the things we carry. We board the scary rides, court darkness, evil. We pump out regular, we squeeze out diesel.
That was Diesel from Coastal Nights and Inland Afternoons, poems 2001 to 2006 by Al Young, who was the California Poet Laureate when this came out. This is New Letters on the Air. So tell me about how you got the idea to write about Rudolf Diesel. Do you remember what the impetus was?
This goes all the way back to my dad again, who was interested in automobiles and, you know, fuel sources and all this.
Of course, yeah. Of course, that makes sense.
Yeah, he was always, a good deal of the time, his clothes, you know, had petroleum on it and oil and all that kind of stuff. And there's another poem, it's a much earlier poem, it's in that collection called Heaven, poems 1956 to 1990. And there's a poem in there called The Problem of Identity. And it was about one of my father's friends whose name was Otis. And Otis used to come by our place, and he could draw. He hadn't gone to art school, but he could draw you. You would look exactly like you, and he could draw anything. And I used to stand behind him and watch him. You know, he'd be on the sofa, and I was a kid. I'd be watching over his shoulder. And one of the images in there is of gas and no gas. I don't know where that came from, but I think it comes from a little boy's associations with masculinity. And masculinity had something to do with smelling like gasoline or oil or something like that. You're a real man. You know, you could get out there and do that stuff. So I've always taken an interest in how machinery works. And I'm sure that comes from my father because he was a tinker. He sent for one of those correspondence courses on how to fix radios and electronic devices. So I grew up with him in a clutter of amplifiers and speakers and all kinds of strange radio paraphernalia. He had a Saturday morning radio show, 15 minutes, and we'd all crowd around a cathedral-like radio console. It was a Zenith. That was like a church because my mother and my aunts would take turns polishing it. And everybody who had one of those, they worshiped those things. That was before TV. And we'd all crowd, the kids would all crowd around the radio speaker trying to figure out how did this work? How did they get inside the radio? And they had to drive to Laurel, Mississippi to do it on Saturdays. But it was just so much fun to hear my dad. I could hear the tuba and the bass in the background. And he would always say something in code, you know, to let us know that he knew we were listening, that kind of thing. And he could fix cars. He could fix motorcycles. He drove a big Harley Davidson. And he was a very, very interesting man and always admired people who could do that. He later picked up television, too, and that was his other job. People would bring their radios and TV sets for him to fix them.
He really was.
And he would explain to me how it worked, you know.
That yeah. Kind of,
and a kid can understand anything you explain to him.
Sure.
So I was pretty good. I'm still pretty good at that stuff.
So do you think you ran across Rudolph Diesel just reading something at your dad's place? Or
no, I took a prolonged interest in that whole period. The time that I was born, 1939, that's when it all starts to happen. Do you know my book, Bodies and Soul?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That won the first American Book Award that you won,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, at first that title piece rides roughshod over that whole year, 1939, and that period. And there's something that I'm attracted to about that because it's cyclical. We're in that period again. People do not know how close America came in the 1930s to going either the Soviet way or the fascist way. And we're at that point again. And the Nazi regime, the National Socialists, properly put, everybody always leaves that out, the socialist part, they were up to something that fascinates me. And I studied them for a long time because I wanted to know what was happening in this country. For example, Prescott Bush, who is the grandfather of George W. Bush, he was Hitler's banker. His job was to invest that money for the Hitler regime.
Oh,
and in
wow.
fact, he was so into it that by 1943, he was still doing it. And FDR threatened to take him to court with charges of treason. But people don't know that there were a lot of people who were sympathetic in America. Charles Lindbergh, for example.
Right.
They loved Hitler. And in fact, the Bush family made their whole fortune off of the Third Reich. And submerged historical fact has always intrigued me. State of Mississippi. When I was growing up, part of the family I was farmed out to was my Aunt Doris and her, how shall I describe Cleve? The rascal of her husband, Cleve. He had a taxi cab company. She was a devout Christian and all of this. But the state of Mississippi was a dry state, meaning alcohol was verboten. But they were selling whiskey, beer, wine out of their house. You'd see the sheriff in there sometimes on a Saturday night, red-faced, drunk, you know, sitting in our living room. He'd come out 3 days later, gun drawn. Cleve, I hate to do this to you, but you know, you can't sell liquor in the state of Mississippi, so I'm going to have to take all your liquor. I don't know if I'll take you in or not. I might not, but we got to stop this. Then it would go all over again. I was 7 years old. That was my introduction to hypocrisy and secret goings-on, you know, behind what appears to be reality.
Oh my gosh.
And so that's a lifelong concern. And so the Third Reich fascinated me so much that I read Joseph Goebbels' diaries. He was the propagandist and the minister of culture and information. He wanted to be a liberal novelist and playwright and all of that, just like Hitler wanted to paint. Ishmael Reed, my longtime associate and friend, he says, "See what happens if you don't get these people published?" Big open circ.
Thwarted creativity yeah, always leads to bad ends.
But in Goebbels' diaries, he burned most of them, but a lot still remains. Hitler every night liked to invite all of his staff in the Reichstag to join him with dinner and see a movie. Goebbels was writing this entry. He says, "I told the Fuhrer that I was going to take a rain check on tonight's movie because I'd already seen it. It's one of those silly American movies by Walt Disney Company. It's called Song of the South." And he says, these Americans are very clever because in terms of culture, musical culture, they only have a handful of slave songs. But what they do is they refashion them and redesign them over and over again so that they appear to be new. He says, we Germans have a much larger store of cultural goods, but we are stuck in our stodgy ways. I am going to talk to the Fuhrer about this. I thought, this is ridiculous.
It's craziness.
Yeah.
This is New Letters on the Air, and I'm Angela Elam, and I'm with the illustrious Al Young. Well, we've got to talk a little bit about your collection that won your second American Book Award, oh. The Sound of Dreams Remembered.
Oh, yeah.
And I had marked a few things, but I don't think we have time for all of it. But I thought that we mentioned your spiritual quest earlier, mm-hmm. and how you're always looking, whether it's looking at Elvis Presley on a spiritual trek or this one. I just love the juxtaposition that you have in this particular one. The Buddhist Way Out West
yeah.
reflects on boots.
It's one of my favorite poems.
I think it's so interesting. So I'd love to hear you read that.
You know the backstory?
No, I don't know it.
You remember Citizen Band Radio?
Yeah.
When everybody, you know, had their handle and all that kind
right.
of stuff.
And ham radio.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the other thing my dad did. He was a ham radio guy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and so, you know, early on I was listening to stuff from all over the world, although you had to be careful in World War II because if you were listening to the wrong stuff, you know, you could be picked up. I didn't take part in Citizen Span Radio, but I had a receiver. My wife bought me a receiver at one Christmas. I said, why'd you give me this? It's because you're nosy, and I know you'll like this. So she was absolutely correct. So I heard a woman say, I could only hear her part of the conversation. I couldn't hear the person she was talking to. So you say you're a Buddhist, huh? Well, tell me something. Are you wearing boots? You know, that's the way that went. And I love it when all that kind of ignorance just comes out and expresses itself so fully. The Buddhist Way Out West reflects on boots. This could be subtitled Ars Poetica, the art of poetry, poetic art. The loveliness of poems is that they keep. The loveliness of lives is that they don't. The rising tide one-ups the tide that falls, almost. You come to me in nothing but boots and body mine. Here, blue matches everything you wear or even think in this improvised December of cold feet, a wrinkling cold, twice iced, now tough as lust. Your soulful earrings, blue, go smoothly with the blurred blue of our clouded afternight. Up one-way streets, desire has sniffed us down and wired us to this alternating force for keeps. And yet, who knows what anguished tide will swoop tomorrow up and take us out. So quickly, even poetry, our tree root deep identity, can't ride time's wave unknown. The mystery of love can't hide for long either. Come melt my night. Forget today. Let tides and lives be on their drunken way. Peel off your sea and sky-dyed duds. Unstrap your blues and stay a while. But don't you touch them boots.
The Buddhist Way Out West reflects on boots, included in The Sound of Dreams Remembered by Al Young. You're listening to New Letters on the Air, and this was the book that won your second American Book Award in 2002.
That's correct. In Manhattan, I remember.
Yeah.
Dana Gioia was there.
Oh, was he? Dana Gioia
is the poet laureate of California
yep. now. He was just named not terribly long ago, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And guess who was on the committee?
Were you?
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
I haven't seen Dana Gioia in years.
Well, I've known him since graduate school at Stanford.
Oh, really?
You know, back in the days when everyone was wearing, you know, bell bottoms and big belts and headbands and dashikis and afros and ponytails. Dana, who was a grad student, had on a jacket and suit and tie.
That sounds like
and short
him.
Hair. and he's been very consistent. And the irony is that he's from a working class family.
You know, which he writes about.
Yeah.
You can see that in his work. So that's neat. He'll be a contrast to some of the people who have come before him. So
remember the period of the British angry young men? And there's one famous movie in which you have these two young Londoners, and they're selling candy on the streets. And finally, one of them says to the other, he says, you know, I can't do this much longer. You can do it because you've had a college education, but I'm from the working class and I have to do something better. I always think of Dana.
Well, we're going to end. Okay. You know, I had several other things marked, but there's only so much time. And you are such a joy to talk with. It's just really fun.
What you don't know is that I've been doing radio since the seventh grade. They had a show, we used to call it Educational Radio, WDET in Detroit, which is now part of the
public radio.
Yeah. And they had a show called Youth Wants to Know. And they came and they recruited some teenagers from my junior high. And there were three or four of us on there. And so ever since then, I've always been in radio. And I'm very comfortable with it because of my dad. You know, radio was no big deal. It was just what you did.
I guess we're going to end it with one of the poems included in the Best American Poetry 2016. And it was chosen by Edward Hirsch, who is the guest editor. And I love the fact that you end the whole collection. Your poem is the last one in here.
That's because my last name begins with Y.
Oh, are they all in alphabetical order? I hadn't even noticed that. That's crazy.
Two recent anthologies in which that's happened.
Yeah.
And I'm the last poem in the book. And so Ishmael and I had a joke about that. So you know they're going to read the first poem, and they're going to read the last poem. All the people in the middle are on their own.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear the drummer Omar, poet of percussion. That's in memory of Omar Clay, 1935 to 2008. And I love the fact that this pulls us back around to music again.
Yes, always. The drummer Omar, poet of percussion. Rhythm is the prime element of music. Music is life. Omar Clay. In memory of Omar Clay, 1935 to 2008. We met when it was spring, before the heat of life moved in. We met before blue summer got us up running, racing to some beat we couldn't count on or off. You peeped it, Omar. You showed up every place I turned, New York, the showplace, Mingus, Oakland, Midnights, Dawn. You and Bob James, a silver spoon and fork to match the knife-shy hush of Sarah Vaughan. You aired the groove, yes, you, Omar. You drew all space between the beat into your lungs in micro-breaths. All tempo burned in you. Omar, it cried, hear how my silence sings. We'll meet again, I know. You love to teach. You'll show me rhythm time can never touch.
The Drummer Omar, Poet of Percussion by Al Young, included in the Best American Poetry 2016, published by Simon & Schuster, the year he was the Cockafair Chair, Writer-in-Residence at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We also heard selections from Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry from Sourcebooks. For links, visit our website, newletters.org. Click on the air to sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by UMKC, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Blake Elizondo, Nicole Dorsey, Mackenzie Callahan, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.